learning from the marshmallow test.
What, to me, was really the reason for writing the book, The Marshmallow Test, Mastering Self-Control, was the discovery from many, many experiments that we did, namely that self-control abilities, the cognitive skills that enable it, are actually open to teaching and can be learned.
That's psychologist Walter Mischel, the famed researcher who developed the marshmallow test. We talk with him about his book, The Marshmallow Test, Mastering Self-Control. And grown-ups everywhere complain that our kids lack character. But are they really so spoiled? Or is it just conservative ideology going mainstream?
Those people who want to see kids controlled even more tightly, regulated and mistrusted and told what to do, are likely to achieve those prescriptive goals by painting a picture descriptively of a society where kids are spoiled.
That's Alfie Cohn. We talk with him about his latest book, The Myth of the Spoiled Child, Challenging the Conventional Wisdom About Children and Parenting. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Between 1968 and 1974, Walter Mischel tested 550 preschool kids on their ability to delay gratification, most famously to wait 15 minutes to get two marshmallows instead of getting just one immediately. Those kids who were able to use strategies like distraction to help them wait out the 15 minutes tended to attain higher educational levels and better jobs later in life. Those strategies to develop self-control, ones the researchers themselves explored in setting up their experiments to see what worked, are at the heart of Walter Mischel's new book, The Marshmallow Test. Much of the media hype over the marshmallow test would lead you to believe that the findings say something about kids' innate character. But that's not really what the test and the book is about. It's about how we all can learn ways to break unwanted habits, promote patience and perseverance, and delay rewards so that we can chart a better path toward accomplishing goals. And as Mischel acknowledges in his book, delaying gratification or self-control aren't always the best strategies. For example, in letting our creativity have free range or responding to emergencies. But when we do need self-control, we should have the skills to use it. Mischel's book, The Marshmallow Test, is part memoir, part science book, and part self-help guide with tips for increasing your willpower. It's out from Little Brown. Well, Walter, Mischel, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Now, you were a heavy smoker for long after you knew the dangers of smoking, and you were also the self-control maven. Was this cognitive dissonance?
Well, I must say that my smoking dilemma occurred before I became the self-control maven. When I became the self-control maven, I actually was able to get rid of the smoking problem rather rapidly. But I'm not pretty sure which came first, the cure that I developed for myself or the research that I was doing, or the sequence at this point is very unclear.
So you are the inventor, the creator of the famous marshmallow test, although I understand from reading your book, The Marshmallow Test, it wasn't always marshmallows.
Very often it wasn't marshmallows. The goodies that we used really depended on whatever the kids wanted. So we first established a trust relationship with the children so that they knew they could count on the researcher to come back into the room every time the child rang a bell that was there for her to ring. And we also made sure that that all the goodies were left with the child so that there was no question of trust. It was all in front of the child. And the methodology was really simplicity itself. We developed it about 50 or so years ago, just as my own three daughters, who were very closely spaced, were 3, 4, and 5 in age. And I was fascinated by what was going on in their minds as they went from being highly impulsive, very immediate creatures, as all newborns are, to in just a few years becoming kids who were actually able to have a quite interesting and civilized conversation with you, and sometimes even to wait for something that they wanted. And I realized I didn't have a clue about what was going on in their heads. So I developed the so-called marshmallow test, in order to try to find out what is going on in children's heads that makes this possible. When does it develop? How does it develop? And to go back to your question about it wasn't always marshmallows, it was whatever the child wanted from a bag of different kinds of goodies we had. Often it was Oreo cookies or mints or graham crackers or marshmallows. So it really depended on what the particular child wanted at that time.
Now, you tested more than 550 preschool kids between, well, you started at preschool between 1968 and 1974, and you continue to follow them. They're now in their mid-40s. You say in the book, The Marshmallow Test, Walter Mischel, you say that you were surprised by the findings. Tell us what so surprised you.
Well, I began the research because, as I said a moment ago, I wanted to understand how do children manage to wait for something they really want, like two marshmallows that they can have if they wait or work for them, as opposed to settling for one that they can have immediately. And the work was entirely directed at trying to analyze what goes on, observing what the children do naturally and spontaneously, and then seeing if we could set up experiments in which we could test whether or not the things that they were doing that seemed to work were actually effective, and trying to understand what it was that made it effective. But as these kids were growing up, my own kids were growing up also, and we would sit around the kitchen table, and occasionally my children would volunteer information about how's Sammy doing or how is Debbie doing. And it became clear after a while when I started taking some notes on this that there might actually be a connection between the impressions of how the children were developing and how they actually were developing. So, of course, I didn't use my children's observations. I put that away, but began a series of very serious studies to see how these kids were doing when they became adolescents. And what we found is they were clear differences between those who had waited longer and those who had waited less long. And the ones who had waited longer seemed to be doing better. For example, on their SAT scores, on measures and ratings by their parents and by their teachers of how they were dealing with frustration, of how much grit they had, of how well they were able to sustain their goal-directed behavior even in the face of frustration, and so on. So we did another follow-up 10 years later when these were now, kids were now between 27 and 32, and we found links to between seconds of waiting time when they were waiting for their cookies or marshmallows in preschool, and negatively, what their body mass index was. That is, what their tendency to developing obesity was. Then we did another follow-up when they were in their mid-40s and looked at differences in their brains when they came back to Stanford University so many decades later, after fMRI and so on had been found, that we could actually see how they were dealing with temptations when they were in the scanner. And now in the most recent study, which is not yet published, but which we're working on with colleagues from Harvard University in economics, we're looking at lifelong economic outcomes that may be differentiating, not just kids who did waited longer or less long on the marshmallow test, but also in terms of their lifelong trajectories of self-control, which we've been measuring over all these years. So that's the story of the surprising outcomes. But what, to me, was really the reason for writing the book, The Marshmallow Test, Mastering Self-Control, was the discovery from many, many experiments that we did, and that in the last 25 or 30 years, lots of other people have also been doing, all of which I discuss in my book. Namely, that self-control abilities, the cognitive skills that enable it, are actually open to teaching and can be learned. And they can be learned by very young children. They can be also learned later in life. They can be learned quite easily by adults. And they make a substantial difference to how easily we can deal not only with external temptations, but even with our own negative emotions and regulate our emotions, regulate our feelings, and manage our lives in ways that are creative and constructive and able to deal more effectively with the future.
Now, you also have tried this out with kids who were economically disadvantaged, poor kids, kids in the Bronx. When you talk about different economic outcomes, you know, what you're saying is, I think, is that the people who exhibited better self-control did better, you know, had higher incomes. They also had a lower body mass index. What about the influence of class, of economic deprivation, of inequality? Would that mess up these findings, or how do you weave together the individual influences, the things that we have power over, with the social conditions?
Well, I think you're raising extremely important questions, and I certainly don't have answers to many of the questions that you're raising. But I can say that the studies that we initially did at Stanford University with kids who were, on the whole, highly privileged and came from quite special and rather elitist backgrounds, studies that we have then been doing also with kids in the South Bronx of New York, for example, and kids who are dealing with serious problems of externalization, as it's called, which means they're having difficulty dealing with aggression, they're having difficulty dealing with problems like withdrawal depression as they're growing up. So we have done a research not only with the Stanford sample and the longitudinal work, which has gotten most of the media attention, but also with kids who come from the kinds of backgrounds you're describing. Now, does growing up in an environment in which there is what scientists now refer to as toxic levels of chronic stress, because poverty in itself is not necessarily something that is going to be having a destructive effect, but something that is often correlated with severe poverty and extremely difficult life conditions are conditions in which stress is very high. And, you know, one of the things that has been discovered over the decades since this research began is that the human brain actually has areas in the limbic system, in the more primitive parts of the brain, that are enormously important in the regulation of emotions and in the regulation of impulses, and that the so-called cool areas of the brain in the prefrontal cortex allow the kinds of attention control strategies and the kind of self-regulation that help people to manage temptations, manage emotions, take the future into account, and think in a cool way, which you can't do when stress levels are high. When stress levels are high, the cool system goes down and the hot system goes up, which is this toxic condition, but really quite poisonous condition, in which people are growing up in chaotic environments under terrible stress conditions and have a very, very hard time. So one of the very important things in trying to help people who are living in environments like this is to create reductions in the stress level. And what has impressed me enormously are some of the schools that I've visited in the South Bronx of New York. For example, the KIPP schools, which are academy schools that have been created actually throughout the United States and that are specifically directed at helping kids to reduce their stress levels and to develop all kinds of self-regulatory, self-control skills and character skills that allow them to manage more effectively, even in the very difficult environments in which they're growing up.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with famed psychologist Walter Mischel about his book, The Marshmallow Test, Mastering Self-Control.
Could you explain a little bit more what you mean by hot and cool?
Yeah, when I talk about hot and cool, I'm referring to the part of the brain in which the reactions that we have are reflexive and immediate rather than reflective and cognitive and thoughtful. They're emotional. They're impulsive. They're very important. They helped us survive in evolutionary history. They help us run from lions, for example, or from bullet shots, or from oncoming traffic. But they're not what you need if you're trying to learn at school, or if you're trying to plan for the future, or if you're trying to pursue long-term and difficult goals. That's where you need the cool system, which is the part of the brain, primarily the prefrontal cortex, and particular areas of the prefrontal cortex that deal with the regulation of attention and thought and problem solving, which developed much later in evolutionary history and which are fundamental for self-control and for getting over the stimulus control, which regulates the heart system.
Do you feel that what you have found here, that the brain is plastic enough that even deficits that are caused through genetics or through environmental problems and insults, that they can be overcome through the use of the methods? And we're going to talk about those methods in a moment.
Yes. I mean, I think the message of my book and the message of research on what's called executive control or executive function is a very hopeful and a very encouraging message. So what's executive control or executive function? This is a very important cognitive skill that is regulated by the cool system, that is by the prefrontal cortex. And the good luck that we had in the so-called marshmallow test is that it taps executive control or executive function. What do I mean? In the marshmallow test, the child has to be doing three things in order to be able to delay gratification and wait for those cookies or those two marshmallows that he gets if he waits. And what he's got to do, first of all, is he has to have a delayed goal that he keeps in mind. I'm waiting for the two cookies. I'm waiting for the two marshmallows. So there's a delayed goal that's retained. The second thing is he has to be able to inhibit interfering impulses. He can't ring the bell. He can't start eating the marshmallow. He can't start thinking thoughts like yummy, chewy, sweet, because those are going to make him ring the bell. So he has to be able to inhibit these interfering impulses, and he has to be able to use the attention control system, his attention skills, to do what makes it possible for him to monitor his progress towards his goal, and to prevent himself from letting those interfering responses get him. So how do the kids do that? Well, if you watch them, you see it. And we have videotapes that show that. What they do is they transform this unbearably difficult situation of waiting and make it a much easier one by, for example, self-distracting, by literally turning away from the cookies or the marshmallows in their chair. They can't get out of the chair. They ask to remain in this waiting area, but they turn away from it. When that isn't good enough, they begin to strategically distract themselves. They take off their shoes and start playing with their toes as if they're piano keys. They start inventing little songs and singing to themselves. They start giving themselves quiet, whispered self-instructions. They do all kinds of wonderfully inventive things, like, you know, beginning to explore their nasal canals and their ear cavities and toying with the products they find. They're amazingly imaginative in how they entertain themselves. If they're able to do that, they're able to wait. So adult versions of those strategies are enormously helpful in allowing us to overcome the impulsiveness and the reflexiveness and the immediateness of the heart system, and use cool system strategies to continue to pursue our delayed goals and to inhibit the interfering responses, all of which you, of course, have to do if you want to learn anything in school. That's why it's very important for these cognitive skills to be developed as early as preschool.
But what's interesting, Walter, Michelle, is that in the book, you know, we spoke about how you did quit smoking, and it turns out that was a long time ago. But you still have, you know, you're more of a hot kind of a person, the way you describe yourself. You tend to be impatient. You don't like to wait in line. What kind of strategies do you use to cool yourself down? And how do you make them habitual, things that you remember to do when you need them?
Well, there are a number of strategies, again, discussed in the book. One of the ones that I found very interesting, we discovered again in the work with the little kids, with the preschool children. We developed an apparatus called Mr. Clown Box, who was the big tempter. You know, he played the role, you know, of the sirens in the old story of Ulysses and his temptations in the Odyssey, or the classic, of course, of Adam and Eve. So he was the tempter, and what the children had to do is not listen to him. And he kept tempting them to stop paying attention to their work, which was a very boring task they had to do by putting X's and O's so they match each other on an answer sheet. And he attempted to distract them by flashing toys and so on in his windows and asking them to come and talk to him. He has big ears and he wants to hear what little children are thinking and feeling and so on. When we gave the kids plans ahead of time, if-then plans, if Mr. Clownbot starts saying, ho, 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 come over and talk to me and play with me and talk into my ears and look at my toys in my windows, then I will not do that. I will say, stop that, dummy, and not look at him, but look down at my work and keep doing it. So that's an example of a very simple if-then plan. When the kids were helped to have those plans and to practice them a little bit before the temptation situation developed, they were able to wait and work much longer and much more happily than if they didn't have those plans. Now, since then, there have been researchers doing wonderfully interesting work, studying how such very simple if-then implementation plans can be used to help ADHD kids to not become so easily distracted and concentrate and become able to learn math, for all sorts of strategies in which teenagers can learn. If it's time for me to do my school assignment, then I turn off my text messages. So very, very simple strategies, just like the ones that I was using in trying to stop smoking. Like if I'm tempted to take the next cigarette, then I keep vividly in mind the image that I saw of a patient being transferred on a gurney in the hospital with his head exposed and shaved and his chest exposed with little green X marks painted all over him. And the X marks were there to show where the radiation is going to go. So if you can focus on the delayed hot negative consequences of something like your smoking or your excessive drinking and so on, and if that is practiced as a systematic strategy in the kinds of if-then plans that I was starting to describe, the results can be remarkably efficacious.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with famed psychologist Walter Mischel about his book, The Marshmallow Test, Mastering Self-Control.
Another thing you talk about is the self-taught about being capable of doing some effort. You know, I remember seeing a report a couple of years ago, I think it was in New York Magazine, that gifted and talented kids in New York City fall apart if they do fail at something. They don't know how to pick themselves back up and do something, try again. You talk about kind of the I think I can model. Talk a little bit about how does this work? What are some of the experiments that you did with kids to teach them to kind of keep their butts stuck to the chair?
There's a large section in the book in which I talk about what my grandmother used to refer to as Sitzfleisch, which is a German phrase which means literally, you know, the meat, the sitting meat, the meat in your butt that you're supposed to sit on to stay at your desk and just to keep working. And I think the concept of sticking with it is, of course, enormously important. And when one talks to successful people, it's very clear that they're very much like what Bruce Springsteen was reported to have said to a reporter who asked him, how do you explain your success? And apparently he said, I worked harder than anybody else I knew. And I think hard work is something that is teachable. You can model it. You can learn it. The kind of mindsets, for example, that Carol Dweck has worked with and developed, in which one is thinking about one's abilities not as fixed quantities that one either has a lot of or doesn't have a lot of, and in the same way where one thinks about one's self-control ability, not as some stable quantity that you either have or you don't have or you have a lot of or you don't have a lot of, but rather as a set of skills that with effort can be learned. And an orientation in which the focus is on what do I have to do to learn it, rather than am I smart or stupid, can make a huge difference in how easily we can deal with failure and with negative feedback and keep on going and have a grit in the way in which we pursue our goals. And so again, the details of how that can work is really what the book is about.
And it is a wonderful book. And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Walter Mischel about his book, The Marshmallow Test, Mastering Self-Control. I thought it was very engagingly written, by the way. You really make the science very accessible, but also it's extremely useful in terms of the kinds of strategies I think we can all use. Now, you talk a little bit about the idea that self-control is like a muscle. Is this true?
Well, I mean, if one wants to make the muscle analogy, it's okay to do. But what I don't like about the muscle analogy is it implies that this is all sort of biology, and that you either have muscles or you don't. If the focus is on we can all develop our muscles and we can build better muscles, I don't have a problem with analogies of that kind. But for me, the most important message that comes out of all the research that's reported in this book and that's been done by other people on self-control is that there are very specific cognitive skills that enable self-control to be acquired and to become relatively easy. But as you were saying a few moments ago, it's not just about self-control. It's what self-control does for you. If you have self-control, you're able to persist. If you're able to persist, you're able to succeed. If you're able to succeed, you're going to develop expectations of a yes, I can kind rather than of no, I can't kind. So the development of optimistic expectations and the feeling of agency, of mastery, of I can really succeed, I can do something, still leaves one with yet another challenge that the book deals with, which is how do you find really strongly motivating goals, burning goals that drive you and that give you a chance to develop a life story that's meaningful and that is purposeful and that gives you a trajectory that's worth waiting for and working for and expending effort on. So there is really, it's not just a matter of self-control as being everything. It's rather that self-control, which is a set of skills that are learnable, provide an enabling condition through which one can also have success experience, develop optimistic expectation, have a sense of being an agentic person who can make a difference. Now, we all have to deal with limitations that come from our DNA, that come from our environments, that come from our parenting experience, that come from our bad luck or whatever. But the development of the kinds of skills and expectations that the marshmallow test talks about and has tried to identify give people a much better opportunity to become the agents of their own lives. And rather than being controlled by the stimuli in the outside world, by the environment, they're able to actually have an impact that changes what the environment does. And how do they do it? By changing how they mentally represent it, by how they think about it, in the same way that they change how they think about the temptations that face them. So fundamentally, what we're talking about are ways of changing the way one is representing experience to oneself.
What about for kids? You talk about a curriculum that's being developed, the tools curriculum. Is that something that is being used in schools?
Yeah, I mean, my experiences in the schools have been primarily as a consultant to the KIPP schools, the Knowledge is Power program schools in the New York area. But I also consulted one of my most delightful projects in the last few years was serving as a consultant for Sesame Street, in which we have in the 2013 and the 2014 season, Cookie Monster has been trying very hard to join the Cookie Gourmet Club, the Cookie Connoisseur Gourmet Club, and trying to socialize. If you can socialize Cookie Monster and get him to stop devouring every cookie that's in sight, you can really make a huge difference. So Cookie Monster is being socialized on Sesame Street.
Oh, that's great. Well, I want to thank you so much, Walter Mischel, for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. Your book is The Marshmallow Test, Mastering Self-Control. It's a terrific read, and I highly recommend it to all our listeners.
Thanks so much. It's been fun talking with you.
Walter Mischel is the Niven Professor of Humane Letters in the Department of Psychology at Columbia University. He's a member of the National Academy of Sciences and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Read an excerpt from the marshmallow test by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, Alfie Cohn on what's wrong with how we judge kids today and what to do about it. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The one thing liberal and conservative parents agree on is that kids these days are spoiled. But are they? Are millennials really coddled, lazy, and entitled in the workplace? Are kids really too smitten with self-esteem? And is all the buzz about character building and grit really what should be guiding parents and educators? How about imposing negative consequences and failure? Does that really prepare kids to succeed in life? In his new book, The Myth of the Spoiled Child, my guest Alfie Cohn says, maybe we should try more collaboration with our kids, parenting with instead of over. He says the emphasis on tough love is just old authoritarianism dressed up in new clothing, and the left-right consensus on it is just a sign of how far old-line conservative ideology has taken over the mainstream. Alfie Cohn is a frequent lecturer on the topics of education and parenting, and the author of 12 previous books, including The Homework Myth, Punished by Rewards, and Unconditional Parenting.
Alfie Cohn, welcome to Writer's Voice. This book, The Myth of the Spoiled Child, is a real challenge to the whole prevailing attitude that kids are basically spoiled and need character and limits imposed by parents, strict limits. Kids don't need character and limits?
Well, it depends how you define the word, or both words in this case. To talk about limits is really to go beyond the scope of this book and deal with a book I wrote earlier called Unconditional Parenting, where in a sentence, what I argue is the question isn't whether there are limits and structure, but whether we work on those with kids or impose them unilaterally on kids. In the case of character, the question now becomes what we mean by the term and whether we're focused just on fixing the kid as opposed to looking at the structure, the situation, the environment in which kids find themselves. So, for example, the current education fad to talk about self-discipline and grit that kids need is actually a way of saying we don't have to make school more worthwhile. We just have to make kids more compliant so they succeed at whatever we give them to do.
What's the problem with making kids more compliant?
Well, there are people, I suppose, who value compliance or obedience for its own sake, and those are typically people in positions of power who are unwilling to ask whether it's in the best interest of kids. It's the same issue that we find with managers with respect to employees, parents with children, teachers with students. Those who want to make those who have less power than they do whatever they're told are naturally going to focus on issues of compliance. Those with a genuine interest in making a more just society or simply helping the people in question to lead fulfilling lives will not privilege compliance. They will ask deeper questions about what's worth doing.
A lot of people point out that, well, you've got to get kids used to dealing with the world. When they go off to their first jobs, you hear complaints, for example, in the media that employers are saying they don't know how to follow directions.
And we get back to the issue of mindless obedience versus functional workplaces that are optimally designed and where it's worth working. But let's assume for the moment that there are dysfunctional workplaces where bosses complain because employees ask too many questions and don't carry out orders. The question we'd want to ask, I think, is should we fix the workplaces or should we just prepare kids to do whatever they're told, even if what they're told isn't worth doing? In any case, I think when we're backing this up and talking about children, the question becomes, if kids are going to have to deal with benighted folks, with suboptimal institutions, with difficult people when they're older, do we really need to make kids unhappy now to prepare them to deal with unhappiness later? Or do we want to take a different approach to child rearing, where we love children for who they are, not for what they do, support them unconditionally, provide guidance, give kids a chance to make decisions, and generally offer support and joy to them? That prescription is actually not only easier to defend on its merits as more valuable, but also more likely to help kids get their needs met so they're in a better position to deal with difficult situations later. You don't best prepare kids for unhappiness by making them unhappy now. Moreover, if we want to raise kids who can make good decisions in life, the best way to do that is by letting kids make decisions, not by training them to follow directions.
Yeah, you know, what I find very interesting in your book, Alfie Cohn, In the Myth of the Spoiled Child, is that you say that while it's not a new complaint by any means that, you know, kids are parents are too permissive and kids aren't too uncontrolled these days. This has been going on for a long time. But you say that what's new is that both liberals and conservatives embrace it, that there's you find progressives talking like Fox News hosts.
Right. Even people who are relatively liberal on issues ranging from inequality to foreign policy to global climate change suddenly sound exactly like conservatives in parroting what has become uncritically accepted as the mainstream wisdom about children, what they're like and how to raise them. And so there's this narrative that's been created that's deeply conservative in its premises, but that you find everybody sort of accepting without asking about it, including, I think, almost without exception, all the mainstream prestige periodicals, you know, like The Atlantic and The New York Times Magazine and The New Yorker and so on, to say nothing of thousands of blogs and syndicated columns. And this narrative sounds like this. Kids today are spoiled and entitled, and they all think they're special, and they've been encouraged to get stuff from stickers to trophies to praise without having earned them, and parents don't set limits and are too permissive and indulgent, and yet somehow at the same time, also they've become helicopter parents who are over-parenting them at the same time somehow that they're under-parenting them by virtue of being permissive. And kids have inflated self-esteem when what they need is self-discipline. It goes on and on. And you find article after article after article making exactly these same points, with the authors congratulating themselves for their courage in saying exactly what everybody else is saying, and larding these articles with anecdotes and quotes from people who agree with them, and almost never citing meaningful data to support this. And it is worthwhile pointing out that most of these complaints were made in what we now think of as the good old days. And in fact, in the first chapter of The Myth of the Spoiled Child, I go back a generation at a time, showing that when we thought kids were more, self-disciplined or likely to observe limits and behaving properly, and parents knew how to discipline their kids, that people were saying exactly the same thing. So when you hear these complaints about everything from helicopter parenting to indulgence and kids who are narcissistic, these complaints tell you more about the attitudes and values of the people making the complaints than they tell you about what's really going on with kids.
And what do you think is at the bottom of that? Is that just something that goes along with parenting, that it inevitably devolves into a kind of power struggle between parents and kids? Or is something happening on a social level that's at least reinforcing that, if not causing it?
I don't know the answer to that. My suspicion is that there are different overlapping causes, some of which are more relevant with some people than with others. There are certainly parents who operate out of fear for their kids and in a mistaken belief that they want to prepare their kids for a difficult life, end up doing to them a kind of control that is paradoxically counterproductive to prepare them. I think there are other people who've never been invited really to rethink a model of parenting that's about doing things to kids, and they don't know how to work with kids instead. And some of those parents are just reproducing what was done to them, because we learn how to parent ultimately from the way we were parenting, and we end up reproducing some of the worst things that were done to us. I think other people are just caught up in a society where it becomes a self-reinforcing loop, where we are led to be so fearful that someone will regard us as permissive that we end up overcompensating by over-controlling kids. And those people who want to see kids controlled even more tightly, regulated and mistrusted and told what to do, are likely to achieve those prescriptive goals by painting a picture descriptively of a society where kids are spoiled. And that's a good way to achieve those ends, is to offer a misleading portrait of a place where kids need a lot more control than they're getting. And that's something that many of us tend to accept. And underlying much of this, I think, are a series of beliefs about motivation, about what makes people do stuff and not just sit there. And in the book, I talk about a series of mistaken beliefs that you need to reward people when they do something, and equally important, conspicuously withhold rewards from people who are not successful. And second, a belief that competition is useful, and so we have to set people against each other and teach children at a very young age that they can succeed only by triumphing over those around them, and that therefore any attempt to moderate the toxic effects of competition would be a terrible mistake, because then kids would never want to do anything if they didn't have to buckle down and beat people. And then third, this belief that failure is what kids need more of, and that if they fail, they will pick themselves up and dust themselves off and say, gosh darn it, I'm going to try even harder next time, which, to put it charitably, is naive and erroneous. But, you know, when people make these assumptions, they claim to be doing it on the basis of what is true empirically about children or about human behavior, and making predictions. You know, if you make things too easy for kids, then they'll be indulgent and entitled and never want to do anything. And so what I found fascinating is that when you provide contrary evidence to people, actually, success is more likely to lead to success than failure is, or rewards actually undermine interest in whatever you got rewarded for doing, or cooperation works better than competition. When you show people the scientific evidence, the typical response is to pivot and say, it doesn't matter. This is the way you ought to raise kids. They lost the game. They're not supposed to get a trophy. And people get apoplectic about this. And then you realize it was never really about empirical claims. It was always about ideology. And so what I argue in the book is that a deeply conservative ideology informs our beliefs about children and parenting. And that ideology has been accepted even by people who aren't conservative on other issues.
One of the earliest things I remember hearing about you and your work is that you did not like praise for children. You thought that it's not good for kids to praise them. And yet it seems that, you know, that's goes right along with the idea that it's not good to, you know, have all these self-esteem programs for kids. So tell us, what's the difference between your approach to praise and rewards and theirs?
Yes, this is a tricky issue that takes a little bit of unpacking. I do criticize praise, but from the opposite direction of the sort of much more common conservative criticism of praise, which says, you know, we praise kids too easily, we praise them for every little thing, we ought to raise the bar, make it harder to earn approval, otherwise kids won't be motivated if we pat them on the head, you know, for walking across the room without falling over. My concern with praise is actually that it is a verbal doggy biscuit, another form of reward that is used to control kids. So they have to jump through our hoops in order to get that patronizing pat on the head, just as they have to comply with authority in order to get a sticker or a grade, or adults have to get a bonus or something like that. I'm concerned about a whole bribe and threat, reward and punishment model that consists of, as I said earlier, doing things to people instead of working with them. And so praise sets up, just like other rewards and punishments, a control model that undermines kids' interest in what they're doing. You know, research has shown that kids who are frequently rewarded or praised are less generous than other kids, because they've learned that the only reason to help someone is because they themselves will get some recognition for it. Just like research finds that when you give kids grades at school, they become less excited about learning, because now the whole point is just to get the grade, which is why the best schools don't give grades. They do more informative and constructive forms of assessment. The other problem with praise is that it sets up conditional approval, so that what kids learn is that they have to earn acknowledgement and attention and care from adults by being impressive or well-behaved. And that is exactly the opposite of what children need for healthy development, according to a growing collection of research in the field that says actually it's unconditional support, where we love kids for who they are, not for what they do, that they need. So the irony here is that most mainstream conservative critics of praise don't identify the problem as being control, but indulgence, where we've made things too easy for kids, and what we ought to do is withhold the praise strategically until they've done more to deserve it, and thereby make our parenting even more poisonously conditional than it already is.
Well, I can understand that distinction, but, you know, as a parent and a grandparent, I would find it very difficult, and I think my granddaughter would too, for example, never to give her any praise. I'm wondering if there's some kind of middle ground. I mean, certainly I think she understands that I have unconditional love for her, but we do build up pictures of ourselves, at least partially, by being reflected in the eyes of those who who we respect or admire. So it seems to me that praise is something, maybe a coin that should be used maybe on the change level, but not the $100 bill level.
Well, my argument here is that it's not just a matter of how much of it we do. But let me be clear that the alternative to praise is not criticism or sullen silence. The alternative to telling kids, good job, I like the way you ... is instead to provide descriptive feedback when it's necessary to tell kids what we've noticed, as opposed to praise, which is not feedback, it's a judgment, and to ask kids questions, to bring them in on a conversation. I remember when my daughter was young and loved to draw, you know, I would say stuff like, hey, you drew toes on that animal. You weren't drawing toes last week. How did you figure out how to do that? A comment like that, which is not praise, it's a description and a question, pulls her into the drawing and makes her more excited about what she's doing and more thoughtful about how she's doing it, as opposed to, what a good picture, you're such a good artist, you tried really hard with that, I really like the way you... Those responses, praise, pull kids out of the task and into my face. And now the goal is not to draw. The goal is to get that approval again. And so praise is something that adults feel obliged to give children, more because we have to say it than because kids have to hear it. And whenever that's true, you know, boy, is it time to rethink our practices if we're really doing it for us. Again, what children need is not that patronizing pat on the head that says they've met our standards and pleased us. What they need from us is unconditional acceptance, along with guidance, support, and an opportunity to make decisions.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Alfie Cohn about his latest book, The Myth of the Spoiled Child. Now, you devote a fair amount of attention to the whole idea of perseverance and grit. I interviewed Walter Mischel about his recently published book, The Marshmallow Test. That test was reported in the media to conclude that kids who were able to delay gratification were more successful later in life. But Mischel was actually making a different point, and you take that up. Talk about perseverance or grit and what he's talking about and what your take is on this whole issue.
Yes. Well, there's several questions there. Within the general umbrella of self-regulation come related terms of self-control and self-discipline, grit and perseverance, and then what Walter Mischel talks about has to do with deferral of gratification, where kids, you know, the little kids waited for two marshmallows instead of taking one right away. But Mischel was not arguing that kids do better when they have the capacity to deny themselves and exert willpower. He was coming out of a whole social psychology tradition that said what leads people to do things has less to do with their own attributes and characteristics and more to do with the details of the situation or environment in which they found themselves. So if you look at his original research carefully, what you find is that he was making changes to the situation where the kid sat in the room with a marshmallow to figure out what aspects of the situation, not which attributes or characteristics of the child, made it more likely that they could distract themselves from the marshmallow and wait for another one, rather than need to have any willpower or self-discipline. For example, is it better if they see the marshmallow as opposed to just hear about it? If they're given a distraction technique or they have to come up with one on their own, and so on. And so, once again, what we find, and this is why it's so unfortunate that people jump on the conservative interpretation of this research, that we need to train kids to be more self-disciplined and to wait, is that what we're doing is ignoring the situations in which kids find themselves. So last year, there was an interesting study that found that kids who had learned that they couldn't necessarily trust that something better was coming along later, in this case, it had to do with better art supplies, the experimenter promised, were more likely to grab the one marshmallow and not wait. That doesn't mean there's something wrong with the kids and we need to train them to show more self-discipline and patience. It means they're reacting rationally to an environment where it's not always necessarily going to provide them with more later. Now, grit is just a rewarming of the Protestant work ethic, of, you know, Benjamin Franklin's aphorisms and Christian denunciations of sloth, and if at first you don't succeed, try again. And what we find on that topic is, first of all, grit or persistence isn't always the appropriate response. Sometimes it makes more sense to say, what I'm doing isn't working. This strategy isn't paying off. I'm finding no joy in this activity. It's time to rethink. In fact, a lot of kids and adults show non-productive persistence, as researchers call it, because they have too much grit. And of course, all of this begs the question of grit at what? Because lots of things aren't worth doing, let alone doing for a long period of time. So to focus myopically on this characteristic of staying with something, whatever you're doing, and never giving up, even if it's hard, or maybe especially because if it's hard, reflecting an ideology of denial, all of that, what that does is distract us from the more important question of what's worth doing. So kids who persist at stupid worksheets in school and get all their homework done before they do stuff that gives them enjoyment, some of those kids are compulsive and anxious, and the more we adults focus on making kids do that, the less likely we are to ask why they're being assigned this drivel in the first place.
So it's not that perseverance itself is bad, it's the context. You're saying we need to teach kids how to think more critically about the intrinsic rewards and values that they have.
That's one point I made. A second point is that too much of it, even when it's a valuable task, can be problematic. But mostly, I'm not just saying we need to teach kids to think critically. I'm saying we adults are the one who are abandoning our responsibility to think critically about what we're giving kids to do by saying, don't fix the schools, fix the kids to make them more compliant and successful at whatever they're given to do. Some people look at schools, you know, and say, why are kids being excluded from a decision-making role about the curriculum? Because people are much more excited about what they do and more proficient at it in the long run when they have an important role to play in choosing what they're learning. And some people look at schools and say, why are we still using grades and tests when we know better by now about more authentic forms of assessment? Why are we having kids memorize facts and practice isolated skills instead of understanding ideas from the inside out? Let's make education more valuable and responsive to kids' interests and needs. And then, on the other hand, there are those who talk about self-discipline and grit, who say, whatever we're going to do, we don't have to rethink the educational structure. We just have to fix the kid. And that's why notions of self-discipline and grit and deferral of gratification end up being as conservative politically in their consequences as they are philosophically conservative in their premises.
Well, Alfie Cohen, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice about the myth of the spoiled child. It's a terrific book and an important one.
Well, thank you.
Alfie Cohen is a frequent lecturer on the topics of education and parenting and the author of 12 previous books, including The Homework Myth, Punished by Rewards, and Unconditional Parenting. His work has been covered by the New York Times, Washington Post, Boston Globe, and USA Today, and he's appeared on CNN, BBC, and NPR. At the end of our interview, I spoke with Alfie Cohen about his view of the Common Core. Go to writersvoice.net to hear that web-only segment of our interview. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.